Today on New Horizons in Education, Mick Miller, chair of the history department at Boise State and an expert on nationalism and the lands of the former Yugoslavia.
After Tito, the president slash dictator of Yugoslavia, died in 1980, there was no single politician that could come forward with any kind of vision. And so instead, what happened was that politicians with very local basis of power took hold. Ideologies like nationalism and even Marxism, theoretically, they're absolutely opposed to each other. But the reason they appeal to people is that they promise some type of liberation. I don't think you can call Al-Qaeda a national movement, but it is something. And people in that region are attracted to it because it does offer them something that's missing.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons in Education. Nick Miller is chair of the history department at Boise State University and an expert on nationalism. His research focus is the lands of the former Yugoslavia. Dr. Miller's book on Serbian nationalism, titled The Nonconformists, Culture, Politics and Nationalism in a Serbian Intellectual Circle, 1944 to 1991, was recently published. He is also the author of another book and several articles on Serbian and Croatian history before the First World War and Serbian politics and culture since 1945. Dr. Miller's expertise has been sought by many groups over the years. He has been invited to speak at Harvard on Serbian nationalism, was interviewed about the Kosovo crisis several times on NPR, and is currently on the editorial board of the journal Nationalities Papers. In September, he traveled to the Netherlands to testify at the Hague War Crime Tribunal for Jadranko Perlić, former president of the rogue state of Herzeg Bosna. Dr. Miller is a recipient of fellowships from the International Research and Exchanges Board, the Andrew Mellon Foundation, and other organizations. His research has taken him to the former Yugoslavia several times, most recently to Bosnia in 2000, when he acted as historical advisor and field producer for a documentary titled From Bosnia to Boise and Back. Nick Miller, welcome to New Horizons in Education.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, let's start with your recent experience. This is just fascinating. You get to travel across the world and over to The Hague. I think many people think The Hague is a building because it's one of the few cities in the world that has the in front of it. But it's a beautiful city, I take it. And you were visiting there because you were a witness at a trial. But let's start with The Hague as the city of peace and justice. It's the home of the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, and the International Criminal Tribunal for a former Yugoslavia. I won't list all the rest of the things that you can find at The Hague that relates to international politics and relations and justice in particular. What specific agency were you appearing before?
I was appearing at the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, which is actually part of the United Nations. So dealing specifically with war crimes trials for the former Yugoslavia.
And when was this set up?
This was set up in 1993, initially, and it was a very small, almost a test case for war crimes tribunals at the time, very small operation that has now developed into an extremely large one. Mm-hmm.
But The Hague as a city has been the home to these international tribunals, what, going all the way back to the League of Nations?
Even beyond. You know, at the turn of the century, it was, I think, without any purpose, it was just sort of accidentally chosen to be the site of a couple of peace conferences and peace congresses. Mm-hmm. And then after the First World War, it did house some of the agencies of the League of Nations. And then over time, I think it just sort of, frankly, catered to this type of group. It took on this identity. And now today, yeah, it's got an awful lot of similar operations going on. Mm-hmm. It has its reputation.
Mm-hmm. Now, everybody who reads the newspaper or listens to the or watches the news has heard of Milosevic, but I dare say most of us aren't familiar with this Jadranko Perlić. Maybe you can help tell us who is Perlić? What did he do? First of all, going back to the days that Tito and Yugoslavia was in power, where was he in his career then, and what wound him up in a trial, international war trial?
You know, it turns out that an awful lot of the really, really bad things done in former Yugoslavia were done by people that we've never heard of. You know, mm-hmm. True small fry.
Right.
This guy, Jadranko Perlić, is more or less an organized criminal. And before the wars, he actually was a good communist. He was part of the system, like an awful lot of these guys. They saw an opportunity when the state began to fall apart. They embraced, probably falsely embraced nationalism. They embraced it as a way to get ahead. He was the prime minister of a little breakaway part of Bosnia called Herceg Bosna. The capital city would be Mostar. He and the other five people that are on trial with him ran this little mini state with an awful lot of help from Croatia. They were responsible for the siege of Mostar, which killed many thousands of Muslims. They were also responsible for setting up camps, death camps, rape camps, other kinds of camps on their territory. They are really just sort of a slice of Bosnian life at this time. They weren't major figures, but they accomplished a lot of awful, lousy stuff. Mm-hmm.
And how did he get to The Hague to stand trial?
He got to The Hague because after the wars were over, they really started, the ICTY began to focus on actually indicting people that they now knew had committed war crimes. It was very fuzzy and very unclear as the war was going on. You know, Perlich was actually arguably one of our allies, which is kind of typical and sad. But in 2004, they finally got around to analyzing the situation in Herceg Bosna. They had already indicted an awful lot of Serbs and Muslims from Bosnia and Serbia. And these guys were, they just stood out for what they'd accomplished, I guess, in a negative sense. And so they were finally indicted in 2004 after having spent most of the decade preceding that as, kind of statesmen in good standing, strangely.
So in 2004, he's physically removed from his homeland and taken to The Hague?
He went willingly to The Hague. He was indicted, and he and his colleagues went willingly to The Hague, where they went through the initial processes of the indictment and sort of acknowledging the process. And then they were set free on their own recognizance until the trial began about a year ago. And now they're back at The Hague permanently, and hopefully permanently in the future.
But you mean permanently, at least for now, on trial.
They're not allowed to leave.
Right.
That's right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the nature of the trial. Who's the judge? Who's the jury? I assume in this case there really isn't a jury.
There's not a jury. The judges serve as the jury. The judgment comes from the tribunal's judges. It's an odd process to anybody familiar with American justice. We all, as a witness, I sit in the room with three judges, the prosecution, and of course with six defendants. There were 12 defense lawyers, all of whom had the right to cross-examine me, which was interesting.
12 people?
Yeah. They didn't all do it, but they could have. The six defendants sit off to the back, and what's really odd about it is that almost anybody can ask you a question as a witness at any time. The defendants can stand up and object to the proceedings. They can just spout off at any point. It was a little odd and a little uncomfortable.
A little unruly?
A little unruly. I was used to sort of the law and order vision, from television where objections matter and people actually follow some type of rules.
Now, what were the actual charges? I mean, I know what you said this guy did, but what were they able to nail him with?
Well, the indictment goes on for about 50 pages.
Wow.
So it's like, village by village, down to the most basic level. They are accused of being responsible for murders of individual citizens of Herceg Bosna, on up to more global accusations, simply like general accusations of crimes against humanity based on all of the others. Mm-hmm. It's a very specific document. Mm-hmm. And all six of them are collectively charged as being part of a conspiracy to do all these things.
Now, is there defense that this is wartime, or is their defense just complete and total denial?
Partly their defense is that it's wartime, but partly it's total denial. I mean, they're not going to get very far because they actually had eyewitnesses to most of this stuff. But what their general defense is that in wartime, they were compelled to do these things because they didn't know who their enemies were. So they need to bring Muslims of this region into camps to house them because they couldn't be sure that they were enemies. Mm-hmm. This can sort of resonate, I think, in more current events as well.
Now, do these eyewitnesses actually come to the trial, or is this just testimony taken back in the homeland?
No, the eyewitnesses have to come to the trial. And so much of the trial, which has gone on for about a year already, has been taken up by eyewitness testimony, and it can be quite dramatic.
During your time there, were you able to listen or see any of that, or did you just get in time to testify and get out?
I got in time to testify and get out, although I was there for a whole week. And so for the 2 days preceding my actual testimony, I was kind of locked up with prosecution lawyers going over it. It was kind of trying, actually. It was time consuming and exhausting. So I didn't get to see any of the previous testimony, although I could. And you can actually witness this testimony over the web now. They stream it. So I did not meet others, and they actually keep you purposely isolated, to tell you the truth. They like to have you kind of come in, at least appearing to have been under no influence while you're there.
What language is being used in the courtroom?
You can use English, French, or what they now call Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian, which is really a single language. All three of those languages are acceptable. Interpreters are constantly working and translating everything into every other language. Mm-hmm. It's a very elaborate process and very effective. They do a good job. So I spoke in English.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your preparation. I was going to ask you about that because I would have assumed just from doing a few depositions for university cases where lawyers prep you for the time that you're actually going to be on the record. Tell us about that preparation. I mean, it was a couple of days long, you said?
It was a couple of days long. Yeah. You know, we sat for 5 or 6 hours a day on Saturday and Sunday before the Monday testimony. And what they really did was they went through what I had written as my testimony, my kind of affidavits, I suppose, and they went through it line by line, warning me about what type of questions I might get from the defense attorneys. We had already gone over the testimony. I mean, they had already seen what I was producing, and they approved of it. They thought it was appropriate. So we weren't so much, you know, questioning my testimony as they were giving me heads-ups, and it was a darn good thing they did because the cross-examination was really unfriendly.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, I want to get to that, but first let's talk about what it was you were there to testify about.
Okay.
There's two major areas, I think, that you were...
There are, yeah. And, you know, they needed an expert, somebody who's expert in the field of, I suppose, generally Yugoslav history, to establish what to outsiders would sound like very basic facts. I was not there to give any type of eyewitness testimony. One of the reports I wrote was meant to establish, on the basis of, you know, the previous year of warfare in Croatia, the war there began in 1991. The war in Bosnia didn't begin until 1992. On the basis of that year in 1991, what could we expect a war in Bosnia to look like? And what they were getting at, what they wanted, what they were hoping I would be able to say was that if a war began in Bosnia, we could expect violence between ethnic groups, refugee problems, civilian population movements, and, you know, murder of civilians and perhaps even systematized rape, all of which was self-evident from the record and, you know, to an outsider appears not to need to be proven. You know, this was clearly in the record at the time, but they needed to get it into the court record. And so that was one of my tasks. Mm-hmm. The other one is a little bit more obscure, but they asked me whether or not the government of Herceg Bosna, this little breakaway state in Bosnia, had actually ceased to exist in 1994, as it was supposed to by international agreement, or whether that government had persisted thereafter. What the question gets at is whether or not this criminal conspiracy that the prosecution alleges continued to exist even after international law said that the state should go away. And the answer to that was also fairly self-evident. The state did actually continue to exist. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not real fiery stuff, but it's stuff that they needed somebody with expertise to get into the court record.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take them to get this from you for the court record?
Well, the actual written portion of the testimony was about a total of 40 pages for mm-hmm. both questions. I was questioned by the prosecution for 3 hours.
3 hours?
Yeah. Yeah, they take you through it. They also used the opportunity of having me there to get some more documents into the record. Yeah. You know, they had more documents mm-hmm. that fit the questions I was asked, mm-hmm. and so they sort of slid those into.
So did the so-called cross-examination follow the 3 hours, or is this peppered in the prosecution's 3 hours?
No, it followed. It was 3 hours of cross-examination, as it turned out, by, I think, four defense lawyers took all of that 3 hours. Uh-huh. But it actually lasted 2 days. Because the 3 hours is closely timed, and it's mm-hmm. only when I'm asked a question and answered it, I also had to sit there through an awful lot of screaming and yelling among attorneys uh-huh. and objections.
Yeah.
I don't know, we shouldn't laugh. You know, yeah. people's lives are at stake here. But mm-hmm.
you're listening to Nick Miller. He is the chair of the history department at Boise State. He's an expert on nationalism, and as you can tell, the lands of the former Yugoslavia, and he just testified over there on a war crimes tribunal, and we're talking about that. Now, in March 2006, Milosevic was found dead in his cell while awaiting trial for his role in the death of thousands. What role does that play in Perlich's trial?
It doesn't play a direct role, but what Milosevic's death did was provide ammunition to people who thought that the ICTY, the Yugoslav Tribunal, had gone on too long and was not reaching any kind of conclusion. There are people who are concerned with the literally tens of millions of dollars that are being spent on this. And Milosevic's death in an inconclusive trial kind of served that argument. They stopped indicting people in 2004, and so now everybody who's been indicted will go on trial, and they expect the tribunal to come to an end in 2010, I believe. Mm-hmm.
And Perlich himself is where in his trial right now?
They're about halfway through. These trials are all extraordinarily long, thanks to the number of witnesses that have to be called, and thanks to the fact that, as I said earlier, virtually anybody can stand up and speak at any time, so you never know how long it's going to last.
Mm-hmm. And if he's found guilty, what's the ultimate penalty?
The tribunal has produced rather short sentences by sort of the standards that we would consider valid. I suspect that he'll be found guilty because there's really, there's overwhelming evidence. He'll probably be sentenced to between 10 and 15 years in prison, and his co-defendants slightly less. It's been a very lenient tribunal, actually.
What accounts for that?
You know, I think that what accounts for that is just that it's a European tribunal. It's situated in Europe. It's following more basically European rules of process. And Europeans don't hand out what they consider draconian sentences the way that an American court might. So what would be viscerally satisfying would be to see these guys thrown in prison for life.
Yeah.
Simply won't happen.
I mean, when you look at their draconian crimes, you would think that would be the least they would get.
They certainly have earned it.
Yeah. Now, the former Yugoslavia, as I understand it, Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, Slovenia, Macedonia, and Montenegro, and of course Montenegro has already declared its independence. Am I correct in that?
The last one to do so, yeah.
The last one to do so. Your new book, The Nonconformist, looks at the interaction of culture, politics, and nationalism in Serbia. In a nutshell, for those of us who are still trying to figure this out and don't know the players and don't really appreciate the names of the states the way a scholar like you does, how and why did Yugoslavia fall apart? I mean, I know that's a question that you probably need at least 50 minutes in a class to answer. But
I'm teaching a 15-week class right now on that question. I think that the reason it fell apart was that after Tito, the president slash dictator of Yugoslavia, died in 1980, there was no single politician that could come forward with any kind of vision. And so instead, you know, what happened was that politicians with very local basis of power took hold. Milosevic among the Serbs, Franjo Tuđman among the Croats. They were able to appeal to their people, but they couldn't appeal more broadly. And, you know, that, I think, is what set the collapse in motion, that nobody could fill that Tito role.
When it comes to the sense of nationalism, is it different for the Bosnians than the Serbs?
Yeah, it's radically different. Actually, you know, nationalism is a very complicated topic, but I guess in a nutshell, if I can, Serbian nationalism is something that's rather deep-rooted. The Serbs have had a sense of themselves as a nation since the 13th, 14th century, to be honest. I mean, you can trace it that far back. Muslims, I mean, there's a contradiction even in the term. You know, to us, that's a religion. But Muslims in Bosnia, as a separate nation, were actually given that status in 1968 in Yugoslavia. It was a formal status bestowed upon them by the Tito regime. It's a very new idea, and I think you could argue that an actual sense of nationhood for those people didn't emerge until they were actually besieged and murdered and put in camps in the 1990s as a result of that identification. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's, that danger is what actually helped consolidate a notion of Muslim nationhood.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the local situation here and tie it back. I mentioned in your introduction that in 2000 you did act as an historical advisor and field producer for this documentary about a Bosnian family that had resettled in Boise. I can remember first coming to Boise, and I was living in a motel for the first couple of weeks in the midst of a Bosnian community here and was somewhat surprised, and still to this day don't really understand how that all happened. So help us, for those of us who meet our fellow citizen Bosnians on the street here, how does that relate to what happened over there? How did they get here? Under what conditions?
Sure. Well, they came here as refugees, and the vast majority of our Bosnians in Boise are Muslims, although not exclusively. The State Department settled Bosnians according to, you know, I mean, they would find cities and towns that had refugee agencies. They would settle them according to quotas, but they also tried to settle them in groups. And so what we have in Boise, is Bosnians from two specific groups or categories. About half of the 5,000 or so that were originally settled are from a town called Velika Kladuša, way up in northern Bosnia. And the rest come from eastern and southern Bosnia, around Sarajevo. Those communities are hostile to each other, or at least they were, even though they're all technically Muslims, because that northern group in Kladuša was surrounded by Serbs and thus found it more expedient to actually go along with the Serbs, you know, to work with the Serbs for their own survival. The southern and eastern Bosnians were attacked by the Serbs mercilessly, and so they did not see things the same way. So if you, you know, it's not really this way anymore, but up until recently, those communities were quite hostile to each other. They didn't get along. They didn't mix in Boise. So it's interesting that, you know, the war was, in a sense, transported to Boise. Mm-hmm.
The word nationalism sounds too generous for this description. It sounds like sectionalism and regionalism more than nationalism, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, in this case, I mean, when I teach this class on nationalism, which I teach once in a while, I have to deal with, you know, the concept of tribalism. A lot of people just say, well, isn't this just tribalism? Small groups of people right. acting hostily towards others. And yes and no. Nationalism as an idea just says that nations should have a state of their own. It's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. The nation part is what's difficult, you know, what actually defines a nation. Mm-hmm. And here you have an example of just how complicated it could be. Mm-hmm. Northern Bosnians versus Muslims from Kladuša versus the others. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So in other words, there's no easy way to tie this up. But nationalism itself has to have that political element. Mm-hmm. We want a state of our own. Otherwise, it's something else. Mm-hmm.
So these Bosnians with differences of opinion, you might say, mm-hmm. now come to Boise. They're living here. Mm-hmm. Do they have a group identity now that they're here? Have they managed to overcome their differences back in their homeland? And I'm from Chicago, and generations of Poles settled in Chicago over the years. And, of course, they formed their own organizations and were united in their politics. Mm-hmm. Is that the case here in Bosnia?
I don't think so.
In Boise,
having the same problem. I don't think that is the case here. I think that instead what's happening in Boise is that the Bosnians are becoming American. Mm-hmm. I mean, 10 years ago, I had students with Bosnian names who didn't speak English, and it was very difficult for them. These days, I've got students with Bosnian names who are Americans. They've grown up here, and I think that that's what's happening. The two communities get along better now, that's for sure. But in this case, I don't think that they're actually maintaining kind of that group identity from home. It's disappearing, which I...
Not celebrating their culture, for example?
Well, they celebrate it, but yeah. I don't think it's politicized.
I see.
I don't think that they're actually... I think they're here to stay. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to sustain their culture. There's no question about
right.
that. But I don't
right.
think, you know, unlike a lot of communities like the Poles in Chicago,
right.
I don't think you're going to find Boise's Bosnians actually becoming political in their home
right.
sense. You
right.
know, actually fighting the war
yeah.
in the United States anymore. That
yeah.
kind of thing, I think, is gone.
Yeah. Do you have relationships with the Bosnian community?
Off and on.
Yeah.
I have. You know,
yeah.
in the 90s, my wife and I volunteered, you know, taught English. And then I worked on that documentary, which brought me into contact with a lot of local mm-hmm. Bosnians. But today, I'd say no. You know,
yeah.
it's just nothing yeah. direct.
Do you speak the language?
I do.
Did
it's
you
difficult.
Use it in the trial?
I did not, because yeah. I did not want to be misunderstood.
Right.
You know,
sure.
the translation is so good that there was really no reason to.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole sense of nationalism that reaches across the globe, we've had Francis Fukuyama write a book called The End of History. We had Daniel Bell write about the end of ideology. There were folks who at one point really said the end point of mankind's ideological revolution and the universalization of Western liberal democracy is finally here. We've arrived.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about liberal democracy. You've been through a situation and experience in these last dozen years where it doesn't look to me like this planet's globalized nearly to the extent that we like to talk about the global economy and we live in a global community. But you have seen tribalism, regionalism, sectionalism, nationalism of the highest order. This apparently just isn't going away.
No, I don't think it's going away. And I don't think it's going away for a very simple reason. Ideologies like nationalism and even Marxism. Theoretically, they're absolutely opposed to each other. But the reason they appeal to people is that they promise some type of liberation. And as long as there are people who feel oppressed, and I haven't noticed that going away, that nationalism mm-hmm. will have an appeal.
Mm-hmm.
It might be irrational. It might be hard to actually explain. But these are ideologies that mm-hmm. appeal to people who want to be free of something.
Mm-hmm.
And to this moment, that you know, the globalization hasn't eliminated the sense of oppression among many peoples globally.
And isn't that what you found in your book? Here you do this study of three mm-hmm. intellectuals, and they're searching for the good life, and they think communism and Tito probably has it all wrapped up for them. And then they live through it for a while and decide, you know, this isn't it. And, I'll let you tell the rest of the story.
Yeah. Now, these are guys, these three men who were very influential in the 1980s and 90s, began their careers in the 1940s as either committed communists or people of the left, let's say. And so they were willing to give communism in Yugoslavia a chance. And they discovered instead, or at least they perceived, that communism really destroyed their sense of dignity for all sorts of reasons. And so they turned in the opposite for them direction, you know, towards nationalism. They began to see communism as an affront to Serbian dignity, in fact. And so the logical response was to move back into their community and try to build up that dignity once again from within. I think that that was an entirely positive process for much of the time they were active. Unfortunately, once Tito died, it did what a lot of national movements do, which is kind of lapse into extreme hostility to others and paranoia. But nationalism served them as a way of giving them something to hang on to at a time when their value system seemed to have been turned over.
Mm-hmm. Where are they now?
Two of them died, actually, in 1997. The main character in the book is a novelist named Dobrica Čosić, and he still lives in Belgrade. And at this point, having been kind of a tribune of very aggressive nationalism before and during the wars, he's in retirement, and he is considered by most Serbs to be something of a pariah, I suppose, mm-hmm. an embarrassment. Mm-hmm. I think he deserves that fate. Mm-hmm.
When it comes to this concept of nationalism, are there factors that make it more difficult? The role of technology in the world today, how easy it is for people to link up across the globe beyond nationalities. I just wonder if there isn't some ways that we dilute nationalism by the technology we have available to us today across the world.
I think that's possible, that over time globalization will result in some type of dilution of national feeling. I'm not going to say that that couldn't happen. But when that process begins, it will be, I bet, because some other type of identity has stepped in to serve people who mm-hmm. feel a need for some type of liberation. Mm-hmm. And for instance, I don't think you can call in any way Al-Qaeda today a national movement, but it is something, and mm-hmm. people in that region are attracted to it because it does offer them something that's missing.
Yeah.
It offers them some type of liberation. That's not to say it's positive at all, mm-hmm. but you know, movements like nationalism will exist, I think, as long as there is that raw material.
Mm-hmm. So give us a scorecard on these former Yugoslavian countries that are now independent and trying to build their futures. Who are the real success stories, and where do we still have to wait and see?
Success stories move in descending order from north to south and west to east. Slovenia has a strong economy. It's part of European institutions. It's doing well in every way. And I think one of the reasons for that is that it had no or virtually no ethnic minorities. There was never a real war fought there. Mm-hmm. Croatia is doing the next best for the same reasons. It is now today close to ethnically pure Croatian, but that's because it actually expelled all of its Serbs, about 250,000 of them, in 1995. Beyond that, you know, Bosnia's economy is growing, but it still has no sense of political cohesion because the Dayton Accords actually established that Serbs, Croats, and Muslims there should try to live together, which I don't believe will actually work over the long haul. Serbia is still a pariah state in Europe and kind of globally. It gets very little aid. It's being told that in order to get more aid, it has to behave better and specifically turn over some indictees to The Hague. Mm-hmm. It doesn't show many signs of doing that. Mm-hmm. And Kosovo, of course, is still an issue. Mm-hmm. The war in 1999 fought over Kosovo still has not been settled. It's still technically a mm-hmm. part of Serbia on the verge of independence. Macedonia and Montenegro are both just sort of stumbling along. Their mm-hmm. economies are very poor. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure anybody really got what they wanted out of that war. In mm-hmm. other words, the subtext here is that this was not a successful operation right. for anybody, but maybe the Slovenes.
Nick Miller, thank you so much. We've run out of time, but I really do appreciate your insights on a very complicated yet timely subject. Thanks for being here at Boise State and doing what you do.
Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Nick Miller, professor of history at Boise State University, here today on New Horizons in Education. Next week, Karen Bubb, interim director of the Boise City Arts Commission, to talk about the role of public art in the life of a city. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research provided by Kathleen Craven. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons in Education. We'll be right back.